From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscowane. The years from 1958 to 1964 were extraordinary ones for the United States. They were no less extraordinary for the man who would evolve from a Senate power broker to an isolated, powerless vice president to commander-in-chief during that time. Lyndon Baines Johnson has been the subject of a series of books by our guest, historical biographer Robert A. Caro. The fourth volume, The Passage of Power, just came out, and it chronicles LBJ's life and leadership during some of America's most turbulent years. For his biographies of Robert Moses and Lyndon Johnson, Mr. Caro was awarded not one but two Pulitzer Prizes for biography, as well as the National Book Critics Circle Award for Best Nonfiction Book of the Year. Mr. Caro, welcome to Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you with us, and I thought it might be nice to start off with a little bit of sound we have from Lyndon Johnson, and this was November 22nd of 1963. It was just days after the assassination. It was from Andrews Air Force Base. I'd like you to hear this, and then we can talk about it. Here we go.
This is a sad time for all people. We have suffered a loss that cannot be weighed. For me, it is a deep personal tragedy. I know that the world shares the sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear. I will do my best. That is all I can do. I ask for your help and God's.
And that was the day of the assassination, November 22nd, 1963. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, that was quite a day, and quite a day for Lyndon Johnson. You know, he's in the third car, two cars behind John F. Kennedy. Suddenly, a shot cracks out. Now, some of the people in the motorcade think it's a motorcycle backfire. Some of them think it's a firecracker. But the Secret Service agent in the front seat of Johnson's convertible is a hunter. And he told me he knew instantly it was a hunting rifle. And at that same moment, he sees President Kennedy two cars ahead starting to slump toward the left. Instantly, he whirls around, grabs Johnson by the shoulder, and throws him down on the floor of the back seat of the car, leaps over the front of the front seat, and lays on top of Johnson. Johnson was later to say, "I'll never forget his elbows in my back and his knees in my back." As the car speeds, you know, there's three cars, the car with President Kennedy, the follow-up car filled with Secret Service agents, and Johnson's car, speed up an expressway, taking a left, going on another expressway to Parkland Hospital. When they get there, the agent lying on top of Johnson says, "Now, when this car stops, don't look around. Don't stop for anything. We're going to get you into a secure place in the hospital." The car stops next to Kennedy's car. Johnson is yanked out by the Secret Service agents so fast that he never has a chance to look at what's in the back seat of President Kennedy's car, which is really the president's body. He's run through the hospital. They're looking for a safe room. We have four agents with their hands on him. Behind them is an agent carrying an automatic rifle. They find the last cubicle in what's called the Parkland Hospital Minor Medicine section. So Johnson is standing against the back wall in that cubicle. Lady Bird's in a chair sitting beside him. Johnson is standing. In front of Johnson is the Secret Service agent, Rufus Youngblood. In the room between that cubicle and the corridor are two more agents, and at the door is a Secret Service agent with instructions not to let anybody pass unless he actually knows his face. And Johnson stands there for like 40 minutes before anyone gives him word. He keeps sending out to find out how President Kennedy is. All he can get back is the doctors are still working on him. And then Kenny O'Donnell, who was one of President Kennedy's closest aides and friends, walks through the door. Lyndon Johnson's wife, was to write in her diary, "Seeing the stricken face of Kenny O'Donnell, who loved him so much, we knew." A moment later, an agent comes through the door and says to Johnson, Mr. President. It's the first time he's ever been called that.
Wow.
So that's how the day starts.
Well, and you know, we don't really hear about that story from Johnson's perspective.
No. There's been like hundreds of books on the assassination, and there's very, very little on what what was happening to Lyndon Johnson, although he was president of the United States now.
Well, so you have this man who is vice president, and from what I understand, he's very frustrated in that role. He feels isolated. Now, all of a sudden, this role is thrust upon him in this moment of crisis, and at a time when the nation was in crisis on many levels. I mean, he had a lot on his plate from the moment that he was sworn in.
Oh, you know, you because these rumors have been disproven, it's easy to forget. What are the headlines saying as Air Force One is bringing him back to Washington? Suspect arrested. Suspect to be charged in Kennedy murder. Suspect visited Soviet embassy in Mexico City. Suspect member of Castro group. So all these rumors of conspiracy are in the air. You know, as Air Force One is carrying Johnson back to Washington, at every Air Force base along the route, fighter pilots are on the runways in their jets with their engines running, ready to take off in case there's some threat to the plane. He has to, on that plane, assume the presidency of the United States. And when he gets off to make the speech you started the program with, he has to be ready to be president. It's quite a feat of taking command of political power.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned a couple things that are interesting there. I hear you get asked all the time about the conspiracy theory and people who still think perhaps LBJ may have had some sort of role in there. What do you tell them when you're asked that?
Well, I tell them that in all the years that I have been going through Lyndon Johnson's papers, telephone transcripts, interviewing just about everyone who knew him, I've never received the slightest hint that would lead me to believe that.
Yeah. What were some of the issues that he was facing in that moment as he took the oath of office and was really sort of plunged into that role? What was right in front of him in terms of the national issues that he had to address?
Good question, because that was one of the great problems. President Kennedy's legislative program was completely stopped. You know, the Southern Democrats then controlled Congress. And I think there were 16 of the 16 standing committees in the Senate, if I remember the right figure. In that year, 1963, the Southerners were chairman of 9, and their allies were chairman of most of the others. And they had stopped. Kennedy had two priority bills. One was a tax cut bill, which was vital to the economy. The economy was stalled. And if liberals wanted increased revenue, which a tax cut would provide by boosting the economy, they had to get this through. He had introduced this bill in January. It was going nowhere on November 22nd. And more crucially, perhaps, he had introduced the civil rights bill months before. That was going nowhere. And the civil rights, you know, marches, people were getting beaten up on the streets of the South. It was the summer of Birmingham and the four little girls who were killed in the bombing. It was the summer of Bull Connor's police dogs and the fire hoses. There had to be some legislative result. They had to feel there was some hope for laws. They didn't feel that there was, at that moment, that bill was dead in Congress. That was a real priority for Johnson.
Well, and as charismatic as JFK was, it was really Johnson who got these things done, and in a fairly short amount of time, if I remember correctly.
Oh, it's, you know, if you're, you know, I don't think of my books as a biography. I think of them as a study in political power done through the prism of this man who understood and used power so magnificently. But this is, you know, he's been master of the Senate, the mighty majority leader, the only majority leader who made the Senate work in 100 years. Then for 3 years, he's a powerless vice president. But he knows, he assumes command. Instantly, the things he does with these two bills are just sort of fascinating. On the civil rights bill, this bill is—it's not even over in the Senate. The South usually kills the bills by filibustering them in the Senate. This bill isn't even over in the Senate because it's stuck in the House Rules Committee, which is chaired by the legendary Judge Howard W. Smith of Virginia. Not only will Smith not hold hearings, he won't even give them a date. He won't even have the courtesy of telling them when he'll start the hearings. Johnson remembers something, that a representative named Richard Bolling of Missouri had, a couple of months before, introduced something called a discharge petition, which means the House can vote to take the bill away from a committee. Now, that petition, they almost never passed that because it's interfering with the chairman's sacred prerogatives, and the House doesn't do that. But Johnson calls Bolling. First, Johnson, that very night, Johnson gets back to Washington. He goes to his office, which is not in the White House yet. It's in the executive office, still in the executive office building. And he calls a couple of allies of his on Capitol Hill. He calls guys who can count, guys who know where the votes are. You know, they both say, you know, there's no hope for this civil rights bill. Just let's adjourn and go home for Christmas. Mm. But he finds out about this, or is reminded about this discharge petition, and he calls Richard Bolling, the representative. And it's something. The call is just pure Johnson. The first half of the call is Johnson saying, of course we could never interfere with the prerogatives of the House, right? Then after a while of saying that for the record, he says to Bolling, but do you see any other way to get this bill out of committee? And Bolling says something, the exact quote's in The Passage of Power, my book, but he says something like, no, this is the only lever we have. And I wrote in the book, if there was only one lever, Lyndon Johnson was going to push it. And he starts to push Bolling. The second half of the call is him telling Bolling that we got to get the petition active again. He works with the House leaders. And there's a remarkable day. He realizes that the civil rights groups do not alone have the power to move the Midwestern conservatives who are needed, who are teamed up with the Southerners, but who has the power? The church groups. By coincidence, there's a meeting, a convocation, that very weekend, the weekend of Kennedy's assassination, of 4,000 Protestant ministers in Philadelphia. Johnson sends people to tell them, don't go right home to your churches. Go home through Washington and see your senators and representatives. Suddenly, the halls are filled with clerics, scholars, labor lobbyists, because Johnson mobilizes labor. And the New York Times, great reporter Anthony Lewis, writes on the Times the next day, something happened on Capitol Hill yesterday.
We have so much more to talk about. We're talking with Robert A. Caro. He is the author of The Passage of Power. It is a book about Lyndon Johnson's life. It's the fourth in a series, and I hear there's a fifth one in the works, perhaps. We'd love to have your questions and comments. The number is 888-477-9499. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscowane. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Inquirer supports WHYY. Every day, the Inquirer features stories about the people, the government, and the happenings of the Philadelphia region and beyond. Plus, augmented reality content every Sunday. The Inquirer. Your life. Your stories.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. Opening May 22nd, the new hospital is being built with all single-patient rooms and has been designed with innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a new rapid-response emergency room and CHOP docs to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Opening May 22nd. More at princetonhcs.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with continuously controlled damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Muscawain. We're talking about Lyndon B. Johnson today. Specifically, we're talking about this newly released book, The Passage of Power. It is the fourth in a series of books on Lyndon Baines Johnson's life, written by historical biographer Robert A. Caro. And it is, as our guest has said, a study of political power through the lens of LBJ's life. We are so delighted to have you with us, and I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation as well. 888-477-9499 is the number to call if you'd like to get in on our conversation here. We were talking when we left off, Mr. Caro, about what a brilliant strategist LBJ really was.
Yes.
And that was something that I guess may have some people may have been surprised by, others not so much, because he was certainly powerful in the Senate as majority leader. But then when he becomes vice president, he's isolated, he's kind of on an island, he's frustrated, he's fairly powerless during that time.
He's almost completely powerless because the Kennedys don't want him to have any power, President Kennedy and his brother Robert. So Johnson tries at the very beginning, to get some power. He thinks he can sort of trick President Kennedy into signing an executive order which would give him, Johnson, supervision over a number of governmental departments. But Kennedy deflects it with such ease. And after that, Johnson really has no power.
Mm. Well, tell us a little bit more about that. Why was there such animosity between Johnson and the Kennedys, and Robert Kennedy in particular?
Yeah, well, it's Robert Kennedy in particular. Well, Tracy, as a historian, you hate to use a word as loaded as hate, But hate is not too strong a word to describe the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy. The first time they meet is a very striking scene. It's in 1953. Lyndon Johnson is the Democratic leader. I mean, he is the line of the Senate. He's ruling the Senate. He has breakfast every morning in the Senate cafeteria, which is on the second floor of the Senate office building. And Senator Joe McCarthy, yes, that Joe McCarthy, has a big round table near the cashier's desk where he sits with four or five staffers every morning having breakfast. This morning, there's a new staffer there. He's a slender little, lithe young man named Robert Kennedy. He's just joined the staff as assistant counsel or whatever his title was. Johnson comes in with two of his aides, George Reedy and Horace Busby. Now, everybody jumps up at the table. Senator McCarthy, they all want to show deference to Johnson because already everybody fears and wants Johnson to be on his side. It's like, good morning, leader. How are you, leader? Wonderful job, leader. How'd you pass that bill yesterday, leader? Johnson walks around. They all shake his hand. One person doesn't get up, Robert Kennedy. He just sits there. And, one of Johnson's aides, the guy behind him, George Reedy, says, did you ever see two dogs who don't know each other come into a room? And all of a sudden, the hair stands up on the back of their neck, and there's a low growl. That's what was happening then. And Johnson, of course, knows how to handle any situation like that. He walks over in front of Robert Kennedy and sort of sticks his hand about halfway out. So Robert Kennedy has to get up and shake it. And that was their first meeting, and it only got worse from there.
Well, what was behind Bobby Kennedy's hatred? I mean, you describe it as hate at first sight almost. What was behind that for him?
Well, the depth of it, people on both sides, Robert Kennedy's aides and Lyndon Johnson's aides, said, there are reasons, which I can give you some of them. But at bottom, they say it was something in the chemistry. Mm. These are just two men who hated each other.
It was just
an
oil and water kind of thing with them.
Yes. And then, of course, there are the events involving the two of them and Jack Kennedy at the 1960 Democratic Convention. The morning after Jack Kennedy wins the nomination, at 8 o'clock in the morning, he calls Lyndon Johnson. Johnson's still asleep, but Lady Bird takes the phone. And Jack Kennedy says he wants to come down. Now, Kennedy's suite They're both in the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles. They're both in the same wing. Their suites are directly above each other, separated by a floor. Kennedy, the number on the door of Kennedy's suite is 9334. Johnson's is 7334. Jack Kennedy comes, and they're connected by a back staircase. So Jack Kennedy comes down at 10 o'clock, and in effect, he offers Johnson the vice presidency. He goes back up to the room where a bunch of northern bosses are waiting. They can count, and they know Kennedy's not going to win without the votes of Texas, and he has to take back some of the southern states that Eisenhower took away. And Kennedy says, he hasn't said yes, but it looks like he's going to take it, and they will congratulate him, and they're all happy. Three times after that day, Robert Kennedy comes down those back stairs and tries to persuade Lyndon Johnson to withdraw from the ticket. Whether he did it with his brother's knowledge or not, Robert Kennedy said, of course my brother knew about these attempts. He said, what do you think? When I was so close to my brother when he was asleep, I went down and tried to get his vice president to withdraw from the ticket. However, the evidence is a lot more cloudy than that. And there's at least a good possibility that Robert Kennedy, out of his feelings for Lyndon Johnson, was doing it either because he misunderstood the situation, because he was out of touch with what was happening in Kennedy, or for some other reason. But Johnson never forgets these trips. And to the end of his life, when visitors, in his retirement, back on his ranch, when visitors would come, he would grab their lapels and lean into them and try to and tell them about how Bobby Kennedy tried to force him off the ticket. And that cemented the hatred forever.
Wow. Well, let's go to the phones. We'll start off in Somerville, New Jersey, and welcome Tim to our conversation. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. If Johnson was such a power seeker, why would he agree to become the vice president, knowing that it was just a basically figurehead with someone with very little power?
Right. Well, Johnson, you know, was to say, the only way a Southerner is ever going to get nominated is ever going to get to be president is to be vice president first. And he's probably right in that, because the big northern states that control the Democratic Convention don't like Southerners. So that's one possible reason. Another reason, you know, Johnson was a calculator, always calculated the odds, always counted. He has his staff research, and if he's vice president, let me say first, he will be a national figure, not a sectional figure as he is as a senator. So in 8 years, or 4 years, when the president ends his term, he will be the logical choice to be president. That's one thing he means by the only way a Southerner is going to get to be president. Another thing is simply mathematics. He has his staff look up how many presidents have died in office so the vice president could succeed him, and they find out that the odds are actually the number is 6. And when people ask him the same question you did, why would he take the vice presidency? And you know what he answered? He says, well, 6 of them didn't have to get elected after that.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, it is an interesting question. And from what I read, he was considering running himself, but hesitated for quite a while. I mean, he had predicted as a teenager that someday he would be the president of the United States, right?
Yes, and in 1958, he thinks he's going to be. Uh-huh. He is the majority. He's the most powerful Democrat in the country. He's really the only man who's ever made the Senate work. He thinks he's going to have the nomination. He doesn't realize that this young senator, for whom he has no respect whatsoever, Jack Kennedy, is actually a great politician and a great speech maker and is going around the country rounding up delegates. And by the time Johnson wakes up to what's happening, it's too late.
Mm. So it is interesting that then he enters into this role. He really doesn't have any power now, especially because he's got the Kennedys right there, and Bobby Kennedy, I think, is going to see to it that he doesn't have any power. And yet now he's thrust into this tremendous role. I want to talk to you about what some observations about your books and how they sort of played out LBJ's life. And one reviewer has called your most recent book, The Passage of Power, a more measured, less Machiavellian portrait of LBJ than perhaps some earlier volumes have been. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I don't know about the measured. I think it's less Machiavellian, if you mean. Well, let's put it this way. The first couple of books are about a young man who's desperate for power, and he'll do almost anything to get it. He steals an election, steals several elections, in fact, and his ruthlessness is astonishing even to people who thought they understood the ruthlessness of politics. Then in the third book, he gets power in the Senate. You know, we're all taught in school, Tracy, that Lord Acton's axiom, that all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The more I write about political power, the less I think that that is always true. What I think is always true is that power reveals. When a man has power, when he finally gets it, and he can do whatever he wants, then you find out what he wants to do with it. And we find out that Johnson really wants to pay a civil rights bill, help poor people, and particularly poor people of color, and he's wanted to do it all his life. So the last couple of books, he's doing wonderful things, yeah. You know. So that's the difference. It's the same Lyndon Johnson.
I found it was interesting, the point that you just made about him really having a soft spot for the poor, really wanting to get civil rights legislation passed as a white Southerner,
yes.
that was so near and dear to his heart. Why was that?
Well, I think that Lyndon Johnson always had this streak of true compassion in him. You know, how do you know that he always had it? Or how do I feel I know that he always had it? You know, when he's 20 years old, he's in college, he's very poor, and he has to drop out of college for a year, and he teaches in what was called the Mexican School in a little town called Cotulla in South Texas, down by the Rio Grande border, on the way to the Rio Grande border. And those children, you know, I wrote about that. No teacher had ever cared if these kids learned or not. This teacher cared. Now, you might say that that's just Lyndon Johnson doing the best job he could in any job he had, which was a characteristic of Lyndon Johnson. But the reason I think he truly cared was that he didn't just teach the kids. He taught the janitor. The janitor's name was Tomas Coronado. Johnson felt it was important for him to learn English, so he bought him a textbook. And every day before and after school, he would sit with the janitor on the steps of the school, and the janitor sit with the textbook, and the janitor would say, Johnson would pronounce, I would repeat, Johnson would spell, I would repeat. I think he always wanted to help.
Well, and you were not apparently content to just read about his childhood. You actually went to the hill country of Texas to get a feel for what it was like, didn't you?
Yes, you know, I said, when I started interviewing, I'm from New York. You can perhaps tell that from my accent. There's nothing I can do about it. I said to my wife, Ina, who is the only person who helps with the research on these books, I said, you know, I'm not understanding these people. Therefore, I'm not understanding Lyndon Johnson. We have to go and live there. So we rented a house in the hill country, and not for 3 solid years, but for a large part of each of the 3 years, we lived there, and I did interviews. You know, Lyndon Johnson died so young, Tracy, that when I started researching it, everyone was still there. The kids who went to high school with him, the kids who went to college with him, the people who formed his first political machine. You know, if you said his best friend in high school was Truman Fawcett, and Truman Fawcett lived on the other side of the square in Johnson City, Truman Fawcett was still there on the other side of the square. If you say Lyndon Johnson's first girlfriend was Kitty Clyde Ross, and now she was Kitty Clyde Leonard, but she still lived in Johnson City. So you could find out about him that way.
So what did you discover about him? What could you deduce from having lived in that area for a while, having talked to the people who were critical in his life? What did you come away with?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that. No one ever asks that, and it's the right question. Because the conditions of the Hill Country were what shaped Lyndon Johnson. He was born into a family where there was this drive to succeed in a big way. But it's a land of incredible loneliness. Like, Johnson City is just a little huddle of houses in the middle of nowhere. 362 was the population when Johnson was growing up there. The Johnson Ranch wasn't even in Johnson City. It was 18 miles further back in the hills. When you get to the top of the hill there, all you see is emptiness. I mean, now Austin has spread out, but when we first moved there, it was the same. His brother, Sam Houston Johnson, said that it was so lonely on the Johnson Ranch that he and Lyndon used to go down to a corner of the ranch where there was a fence near the Austin-Fredericksburg Highway. The highway was really just a graded path. And they'd sit there for hours hoping that one rider or carriage would come along so they'd have one new person to talk to. A land of incredible poverty.
Yeah.
And you didn't really understand. If you hadn't lived there and talked to these people, you really wouldn't understand the extent of the poverty we're talking about. I mean, there was no cash there, you know. A friend of Lyndon's, a guy named Ben Kreider, was a few years older, and he said that you could get a dime for a dozen eggs, but you had to sell the eggs in Marble Falls. Now, Marble Falls was 22 miles from Johnson City, and he would talk about how every Saturday he'd ride those 22 miles holding a basket of eggs in front of him in both hands so they wouldn't break, just to get that dime. Lyndon Johnson's father, who was at the beginning a respected legislator, member of the Texas House of Representatives, fails. And he fails in a very humiliating way. He loses the Johnson Ranch. And Johnson has to live the rest of his boyhood with his father being the laughingstock of town. And Sam Houston, his brother, once said to me, to understand Lyndon, you have to understand that the most important thing in Lyndon's life was not to be like Daddy.
Mm. I want to talk in our last minute, and we may have to continue this after the break. But just based on what you learned in that time that you spent there in Texas, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the role that character plays in politics, because we're talking about how all of that sort of informed his decisions and things that he did later in life. What can you say about the influence of character and how it plays into politics?
Well, we all know in life, don't we, that character is the determining thing. It's the same as politics. And people who try to ignore that, in my view, are just ignoring human relations. Mm-hmm. Johnson was a genius in human relations. You know, he was a great reader of men. He used to tell his assistants, he would give them rules. He'd say, when you're talking to a senator or anybody else, read his eyes. Read his hands. What he's telling you with his lips is never as important as what you can read in his eyes. He used to say, never let a conversation end, because the most important thing a man or a woman has to tell you is what they don't want to tell you. And the longer you talk to them, the longer you can figure out what they're not telling you.
Wow. We'll talk much more about LBJ and the book, The Passage of Power. It is the fourth in a series by historian Robert A. Caro. We'd love to hear from you as well at 888-477-9499 when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Athena Health, offering physicians a dinner seminar on meaningful use and profitability, Thursday, May 17th at the Chelsea. Details at athenahealth.com/NJNPR.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY and reminds listeners that careers in healthcare and the sciences continue to be strong. University of the Sciences has been preparing graduates for 191 years with unique hands-on learning, respected faculty, and a stimulating student life. Offering pre-med, occupational or physical therapy, pharmacy, or another of the 25 undergraduate, 20 master's, and PhD programs where science and healthcare converge. More online at usciences.edu.
Hey everybody, Jad here. Radiolab is coming to Philadelphia with a live show. We'll be joined on stage by Dimitri Martin, the musician Tao Nguyen, and the Palabolas Dance Theater. Come check us out at the Academy of Music on June 29th. Tickets are at radiolab.org.
as you bite into that cupcake or find yourself tempted by those hot out-of-the-fryer French fries, consider this. A new study finds that by 2030, nearly half of all Americans will be obese. But just what is giving Americans those bigger waistlines? And why are minorities more likely to be at risk? We'll return to this crucial subject again next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Mattisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the life of Lyndon Baines Johnson. We're looking at Volume 4 of a series of books on LBJ's life. This one is called The Passage of Power. It is written by historian Robert A. Caro, who is our guest today. And we left off, we were talking about character and how it informs political decisions, that sort of thing. And really, the picture that you paint of LBJ is brilliant political strategy. Just excellent reader of people, someone who really knew how to get things done in Washington once he had the power and the opportunity to do so. You mentioned early on about the tax bill that was just sort of lying dormant, if you will, along with civil rights that hadn't gone anywhere. What was it about LBJ's character that was able to take those sort of dormant bills and actually get them through when Kennedy was not able to do that?
Well, he knew people, and he, don't forget, Lyndon Johnson was the greatest legislator. You know, he says, what's the job of a president? To write it in the books of law, you know, to make it legislation. And you see that in just the bill that you mentioned, the Kennedy tax cut bill. This bill is necessary. The economy is stalled. The federal government doesn't have enough revenues. This bill has to be passed. But the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee is Harry F. Byrd of Virginia, who's been chairman of the Senate Finance Committee since the age of Jurassic Park, it seems like. And the Kennedy people, Byrd has said two things to the Kennedy people. He says in this very mild, courtly Southern way, it'd be nice if the budget came in around $100 billion, right? The Kennedy people think that he means about $100 billion, that if they bring it in, the figures they're mentioning is $102 billion, that'll be okay with old Harry, you know, because he's so friendly and all. And they're also talking about, on the tax cut bill, going around Harry Byrd in the Finance Committee, getting the committee to vote over, to overrule him. So Byrd is doing the same thing with the tax bill that Smith is doing with the civil rights bill, these two Virginians who it was said bottled up the presidents for decades. The bill, Kennedy introduced the bill on January 11th, 1963. Now it's November 22nd, 1963, 11 months later. The bill is still in the Senate Finance Committee. They still have 180 witnesses to go. Harry Byrd is still saying we can't have any hearings this week. I certainly wish we could, but I can't get a quorum. The night after Kennedy's assassination, unless it's two nights, I forget, Johnson calls into his office Kennedy's three top economic advisors, Walter Heller, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, Douglas Dillon, the Treasury Secretary, and Kermit Gordon, the Budget Director. And they start talking to find out about the tax cut bill and to talk to them about the tax cut bill. They start talking about the budget. And he says, basically, you don't understand. When Harry Byrd says in a soft way, it'd be nice if you had it about $100 billion, he means bring it in under $100 billion or you're not going to get it or the tax bill. And then they start talking to Johnson about going around Byrd and committee. And Johnson says to them, basically, this is not a quote, you cannot go around Harry Byrd in the Finance Committee. And they say, why not? And he says, because there's 17 votes on the Finance Committee, and Harry Byrd has 9. And they say, how do you know Harry Byrd has 9? And Johnson says, because Harry Byrd always has 9. And instantly they say, it's just remarkable. They say, in their memos on this meeting, they say, instantly the problem was solved. This problem which has bottled us up for 11 months, we bring in the budget under 100 billion, and we can have our big tax cut. And the problem is solved. Johnson was a legislative genius. And when you see him in the first week or two after Kennedy's assassination, when Johnson picks up the legislative program, you see that he is going to end this congressional deadlock. He is going to teach Congress a lesson. You know, on another bill, he says, the Midwestern conservatives have introduced this amendment to a foreign aid bill. It has to do with wheat sales to Russia. No one thinks it's very important. But Johnson knows it's important because it would limit the president's authority. He says he says to his advisors, we have to teach them a lesson. The bill may not be important, but we have to beat it. And he gets enough votes to beat it, but he doesn't stop. And he says in the book, I wrote it wonderful, but it's a wonderful scene. He says, I want to murder this bill. And he stays up most of one night calling to get more and more votes. And you know what? He wrote in his memoir, he murders it. He said, at that moment, the power in Washington started to flow back from Congress to the White House. And he was right.
Wow. So many interesting things that I want to ask you about. Those stories really sort of point up the job that Johnson had to do just in terms of, I don't know if mending fences is the right expression, but really bringing the Kennedy people on board, the supporters, the friends of Kennedy, because they did not like Johnson. So now he's got to win them over, so to speak. Right?
Yes. It was a very hard job because he didn't have much of a staff because Kennedy hadn't allowed him much of a staff. He hardly had any staff of his own. And if the Kennedy people left, it would look to the nation that they didn't want to work for him. He has to get them to stay. And these are people who, many of them despise him. You know, in the Kennedy administration, he has a nickname among the Kennedy people, Rufus Cornpone. They call him Rufus Cornpone, or they call him Uncle Rufus. And they cut him out of everything. He says to basically all of them, I need you more than Jack Kennedy needed you. Now, they would get together at dinner and laugh. He said, did he say that to you? You know, I need you more. Yeah, he says it to everybody. What they didn't realize that Johnson did say that, but he tailored each remark to the individual, like to Arthur Schlesinger, the historian who worked in the Kennedy White House. He said, you know, I don't know history like Jack Kennedy knew history. You have to teach me history. I need you more than he needed you. And they all stay, or at least long enough.
Wow. So many things I want to talk about, too, as far as your creative process goes. This book, number 4 in the series, has been, 30-something years in the making? You've been writing about LBJ for a very long time.
Yeah.
Is it true you write the last sentence first and then write the book from there?
Well, I have to know the last sentence before I can start,
Wow. So do you have the last sentence of number 5 written already?
Well, I know what it is.
But you won't tell.
No.
And the 5th volume will encompass...
go to his death, yes. Okay. And of course, it's going to be a book with a much darker tone because you have Vietnam.
Right, right. And there's a lot to be said about that.
Yes.
So how long do you think it'll take? These books are, 10 years in the making.
Well, this last one, I'm hopeful, will only be 2 or 3 years because this volume that you were looking at, The Passage of Power, was only supposed to be the first half of the last book. So I did the research all the way to the end, most of the research. So I hope I can do this a lot faster.
Is it true you're planning to move to Vietnam to get a feel for that as well?
Yes.
Wow. What does your wife say about that?
Great.
She's up for the adventure,
yeah.
Huh? Speaking of your wife, she's been an enormous help to you, it sounds like, in writing these books.
Oh, sure. Ina is the whole team. She's the only person who's ever worked on these books beside me, and she's a great, she's written 2 wonderful books of her own about French history and travel, about really the intersection of history and travel. The last one just came out last year. It's called Paris to the Past, Traveling Through French History by Train. But she has time, and she's helped me for all these years on these books. She's a great historical researcher.
Well, and a multitasker when she's writing her own book and helping you write yours well.
Yeah.
I want to go to the phones. We'll go to Ardmore and welcome Barbara to our conversation. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi,
hello.
Barbara.
First of all, thank you for this really sympathetic portrait of Johnson. It means a lot to me. But my question is, with Johnson's experience in the Senate, do you see a parallel between, let's say, a Vice President Biden today and a young President Obama?
Well, everybody wants to, draw that kind of comparison, Barbara, and, it's easy to draw. I happen to think President Obama has accomplished a lot more than a lot of people give him credit for.
Oh, I'm not thinking he didn't.
Okay.
I think he did.
Okay.
Well, I think there's also an interesting follow-up to that. What lessons do you think the Obama administration could take from LBJ's playbook?
I wouldn't be comfortable giving President Obama advice like that. So that's a question I want to take a pass on.
How do you feel about the fact, though, that President Obama and other leaders today are reading your books to get greater insight into these things?
It's absolutely thrilling. I mean, one of the most thrilling, my first book was called The Power Broker. It was a biography of Robert Moses. So 2 years ago, President Obama was kind enough to give me the National Humanities Medal. So the citation on the medal is a formal thing, and that was very nice. Then at the end of the ceremony, where he's telling everybody next there'll be a cocktail hour or whatever, he suddenly looks at me and says, "Robert Caro, I remember reading The Power Broker when I was 22 years old, and I think it helped shape my political thinking." That was one of the thrilling moments of my life. Wow. Everyone in Washington seems to be reading this one, The Passage of Power, and it's sort of thrilling to me.
Yeah. What was it that inspired you to write about LBJ and to write so extensively, to dedicate, 30-something years of your life to this study?
Well, it's because, as I think I mentioned at the beginning, I can't remember, I don't regard my books as biographies. I never had the slightest interest in writing a book just to tell the life of a great man. I'm interested in political power. I wrote about Robert Moses because he was never elected to anything, but he had more power than anybody who was elected, more than any governor or more than any governor and mayor combined. So I said, if I can find out where he got his power, because I didn't know, and neither did anyone else at the time, and explain it to people, I'll be adding something to our knowledge about urban power, power in cities. Then I wanted to do national power. And I said the perfect guy to do it through is Lyndon Johnson, because he understood power better than any president in the second half of the 20th century.
Mm, wow. And so that's why there's yet another book on the way.
Right.
We've been talking about President Obama. What did you think of his announcement last week that made lots of headlines, his support of gay marriage?
Well, I thought it was great. I thought it was a gutsy decision, I thought in many ways it reminded me of Lyndon Johnson's, picking up the Civil Rights Bill. I can tell another Johnson anecdote. He has to give an address to the joint session of Congress on the Wednesday after Kennedy's assassination. So on Monday night, the night of Kennedy's funeral, he's not in the White House yet. He's in his house, around the kitchen table, are four or five of his advisors drafting the speech, and he's sitting there listening, not saying anything. And they're all saying, don't use up your political capital in this speech on civil rights. They said, the Southerners control Congress. You're going to antagonize them. You'll jeopardize the whole rest of your program. Don't do it. Don't waste it on civil rights. It's a noble cause, but it's a lost cause. You know what Johnson says to that? He says, well, what the hell's the presidency for then? And you know what he says in his speech? The most important thing we have to do, the first thing we have to do is to pass Jack Kennedy's Civil Rights Bill. I thought of that when Obama made his statement. Yeah.
Where were you when President Kennedy was assassinated? That's one of those epic events that everybody remembers, like 9/11. People remember exactly where they were at that moment.
Well, I was one of the last people in the United States to learn about it, quite literally. I was an investigative reporter for a newspaper, Newsday on Long Island, and I had done a series on these fraudulent retirement home sites in the middle of the Mojave Desert that people were selling, con men were selling them to retired policemen and firemen as retirement home sites, and there was nothing there. They thought it was a development. So I had written about some witnesses, and a Senate committee was going to have hearings on it. So they asked me to go with their investigators to the Mojave Desert to find these people. In the middle of the desert, there was no radio reception. So we turned off the radio all day. That evening, about 6 o'clock or 6:30, we're going back toward the highway back to Las Vegas where we were staying, And this truck driver started waving us over the road, and we pulled over, and he said, did you know that President Kennedy has been killed? So I didn't learn about it for about 6 hours after it happened.
Wow. And for a journalist, I mean, that's that's pretty excruciating to get as news as big as that.
Embarrassing.
Wow. But that's one of those moments that everybody remembers. Mm. Have you ever met LBJ personally?
Well, it depends. Not really. I was a young reporter then, so I was a substitute reporter, and I covered like 3 days of his campaign against Goldwater in 1964, filling in for the regular political reporter. So at one point, I followed him around like the other reporters. At one point, he came around and shook all our hands, but he didn't ever speak to me. So it depends what you mean by met.
you kind of breathe the same air. You're in the same area with him.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for the work that you have done. It's quite extensive. This is, as we have pointed out, the fourth in a series. The fifth one is in the works, and Mr. Caro tells us that he already knows what the last sentence of that book is. We don't know what it is. We'll have to wait to find out. But that'll be forthcoming in the next few years, we hope. And we just want to thank you for the extensive research and how you have really helped us to understand what was going on politically in our nation and what political power is all about through the life of this man.
Thanks.
Yeah, our guest has been Robert A. Caro. He is an historical biographer. Again, the book just recently came out. It is called The Passage of Power, and it is a fascinating account of some turbulent years in American history. We want to thank all who have made this edition of Radio Times possible. Kevin Griffin is our engineer. Our producers are Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, Susan Greenbaum, and Debbie Builder. We want to thank them as well. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. You have been listening to Radio Times. Thanks.